Hi everyone, this is part two of my interview with Professor Cisneros. If you haven't listened to part one, I highly recommend it. Without further ado, let's get right into it.
Yeah, I think those are both like especially important. And about the languages that you have studied in the past, do you see those languages that still persist in our society, or are they still spoken? And do you think that these languages might ever die out in the future?
Yeah, it's sort of a sad thing that we are, especially in this era with globalization, we are seeing a lot of languages go extinct. A lot of the time, it's for a lot of different reasons. You can have like a language can go extinct because like the speaker population is really small. But if the speaker population is very isolated, like you get in the Amazon jungle, then like it can still persist. But it all comes down to kind of exposure to other major languages. So, for example, like in any colonial setting, right? So in North America, it was English and Spanish. Those were the colonial languages. Those languages get taught to indigenous people or just speakers of minority languages, let's say. And eventually, with that exposure, over generations, you get a switch from any native language to the dominant language, right? Because the dominant language is sort of, maybe it's imposed on them, or maybe it's... socioeconomic circumstances just make it more beneficial to learn the dominant language. And, you know, people, you know, if they're in dire situation, they might just want to survive. And that's a bigger, and, you know, have their kids do well. And that's probably a bigger priority for them than to like maintain their language. Unfortunately. Fortunately, nowadays we do have like more resources available for communities to be able to maintain their own languages, and at the same time also learn about, you know, what, you know, their, how to kind of interact more with like the English speaking world or the Spanish speaking world and so forth, right? We have lots of stuff that wasn't available before, right? Like the internet, like better understanding of like language acquisition, how to get your kids to kind of be multilingual and stuff like that, right? And we have better understandings of the benefits of multilingualism, especially with children, right? We didn't have that before. It's like it's a common like folk ideology that like a child suffers when, you know, they speak a minority language and like a dominant language, right? Like what you really want to do with kids is just have them learn both, right? Because, you know, that's like the ability to be multilingual is going to be maximized when they're a kid. And like, that's just going to give them a lot of like cognitive benefits later in time. So that's really what you want to do. Right. Yeah. And unfortunately people didn't really know that like 100 years ago or, you know, before that. So, but yeah, just, I mean, because of that type of thinking, because of globalization, linguistic colonialism, yeah, we're going to lose a lot of languages. Linguists can't make it to every community, every endangered language community. Like we can't unfortunately visit all of them to see what their linguistic needs are, their language maintenance needs. More exposure to any dominant language culture, like film, radio, any type of media. You know, those are all resources for people to kind of, you know, utilize in their own socioeconomic situation, right? Like if they want to listen to the news and it's in a dominant language, that's a lot of pressure to learn, you know, to learn the dominant language because people want to, you know, they want to read the news or they want to listen to the news and stuff like that, right? So yeah, there's just so much pressure now, especially with globalization and like high tech media, that we are seeing like an acceleration of minority languages dying out. The best thing we can do is for linguists to kind of check with every community that's speaking an endangered language, see how important language maintenance is for them. If it's not important to them, then I mean, it's a community. I think a community has, they kind of own their own language. And if they're not, if they're okay with it dying out, then kind of respect their opinion, kind of respect their right to do what they want with their own practices, right? But if they are interested in language maintenance, then kind of provide these, all the resources we have for them now. I think that's the best thing to do. Yeah. There is, so when it comes to language revitalization and maintenance, there is, so the, there is a, there's sort of a pessimistic fact that there's only one case, there's only one like true case of language revitalization in history so far. There might be more since like 10 years ago when I first learned about this, but as far as I know, there's still this only one case, and that's Israeli Hebrew. So Israeli Hebrew, I guess, Hebrew, so I'm not, yeah, unfortunately, I'm not like a scholar of the Hebrew language, but I think for a long time, if I'm not correct, it was more of a liturgical language. It was a language people learned to kind of read their texts, or they'd use it at religious meetings. And it wasn't used for like everyday communication, like at markets, at the home and stuff like that. It was mainly used at religious meetings and to like, you know, to read religious texts. But when I, but when the country of Israel was founded, the leaders, I guess, of that movement to found Israel were very interested in revitalizing much of their ancient heritage, which included the regular use of Hebrew for all aspects of like of social life. So by some like, you know, social movement early on in the country, they were able to do that. They adapted their knowledge of liturgical Hebrew and kind of created a new what's called what you would call modern Hebrew, which can be, which has all of like, you know, has borrowed words and all these new phrases to kind of have it modernized, to be able to use it in a modern setting, right? To have words for cars and planes and stuff like that, right? So yeah, that's often cited as the one case of language revitalization. But you can imagine just from that case, like what it takes to truly revive, if that's the one case of language revitalization, that shows you how much effort it takes to do that. Like the one case we have of language revitalization literally involves the formation of a whole country, right? Of a whole nation, like a new nation. That's given the evidence we have, that seems to be what you really need for language revitalization. And that's like, that's going to be impossible for 99% of cases of language maintenance projects. So it's kind of a pessimistic idea, but I don't know. I've been leaning to that. I think language revitalization is possible. We just kind of have to learn from like the Israel case and maybe see like what are the specific things that work from that, and kind of try to abstract that away from the whole like country formation project. But yeah, I don't know. That involves stuff that I don't know a lot about. But yeah.
Yeah, that seems, it's really interesting how like technology can be the this kind of savior of languages, but it can also like harm them at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there any like I guess just a fun fact about you that you would want to share, maybe about a hobby or something with having to do with your research?
A hobby having to do with my research. Okay, yeah. I used to be jealous of these types of linguists who like were able to translate literature from like one language to another. Like that was their hobby. Like they would read like poetry or books, and they would like translate them into English. I used to be jealous of that, but then I realized that's actually something that I do as a field worker. one of my consultants, this guy that I work with for my Mishtik data, he's actually a rap artist based in Fresno, California. And part of my work is actually like transcribing and glossing and translating his rap lyrics. So I was kind of doing, so it's not like literature, but then it is. It's sort of like the literature of this community. So he's from a village of like a few hundred people. So in a way I'm translating like the new literature of this village, basically, because he's the author of it. So it took me a while to realize that, but once I realized it, I realized how cool that is. So that's, I guess that would be my fun fact. I translate like rap. I've translated native language rap lyrics into English. Yeah,
that's actually really interesting. That's mm-hmm. cool. So yeah. Is there anything else you'd want to add about your research, or just anything? No worries if not.
Anything else I'd want to add about my research? I don't know. My instinct right now is to just kind of talk a little bit more about the regions that I work in. So I mentioned before that the languages I work on are Mixtec and Waimi, which are spoken in southern Mexico and Panama, respectively. These areas. So I got interested in working in those languages because, first Mixtec, I started working on Mixtec when I was in college. I got into that because I just want, being in California and being interested in Mesoamerican culture and language, I kind of just wanted something easy to start with, to learn about Mesoamerican languages and like just in the area that I could find in California, in either Central California or Southern California. And the most accessible language for me turned out to be Mixtec. Because in Fresno, around Fresno, there's a large Mixtec community, or Mixtec diaspora community, mainly based in Madera. And then San Diego also has a pretty sizable Mixtec community. 10 years ago, it was like, I think, estimated to be 20,000 members of the Mixtec diaspora community in San Diego County. That number might be, it might have grown by now, but I'm not sure. So for me, being someone who wanted to learn more about Mesoamerican culture, that was the most accessible thing. So I did volunteer work with this nonprofit that worked for the community. That's how I was able to access the community. And I kind of just did my field work with them, you know, kind of offering them certain services like English lessons, sometimes math tutoring for their kids. And then, they would kind of give me their own language data in return. And that was fun. So that's kind of how I got started research on Mixtec. A lot of my field work, because that's the relationship I developed with the community, a lot of my field work ended up being in California itself with the diaspora community. I've actually only been to Oaxaca state, where the Mixtecs are from. I've only really been there a couple times, like many years ago. I haven't been there in like 10 years. I forget what year I went. I think it was 2010. I want to say it was 10 or 12 years ago that I went to Oaxaca. So even though I've been studying Mixtec, I haven't really been to I've hardly been to the place where they're from, because I'm always working with the diaspora community in California. I meet speakers in California, like the rap artist that I told you about. Like, he's kind of based here more than in Mexico. So that's kind of the nature of my work with them. If it was easier to kind of travel to Oaxaca, especially nowadays, it's not as easy. But if my career trajectory maybe pushed me more to
to go to Oaxaca, I would have loved it because when I went, it's Oaxaca's a super interesting part of Mexico. I'll just kind of promote it now. A lot of Mesoamerican culture is preserved in southern Mexico. So things like, so obviously the languages have been preserved, right? But not only that, there's a lot of the ancient culture that's preserved. Things like, so the Mixtecs, there's at least one village, maybe several, that kind of identified themselves with the Mesoamerican rain god, who's called Tlaloc in Nahuatl, the Aztec language, or Dawi in Mixtec. I guess that was maybe a broader tradition among the Mixtecs to kind of venerate the rain god, or to kind of recognize the rain god as a source of like seasons for good yield for corn, right? Just to have rain so that, you know, they could have a lot of corn in a particular season. And you actually still see this in some villages. You still see, find these sort of rocks that are semi-carved, and their names are often the name of the rain god, or sometimes they've been Catholicized into like some angel's name or some saint's names, but in some village, it's still the name Dawi for the rain god.
Oh, okay.
And, they basically like, Mixtecs will go to these rocks and then provide offerings, and for rain, just to kind of make sure that they have rain for like their corn season.
Oh, that's
so that's something that's still left over from the pre-Columbian era of, like, you know, going to gods for like offering things to gods or spirits or stuff like that. Before there was more sacrifice, obviously there was like auto sacrifice being like bloodletting, or like, you know, like cutting yourself and offering your own blood to the rain god and stuff like that. They don't do that anymore, but they do still offer things like fruit and stuff, maybe like under pressure from like friars who wanted them to be more like Catholic, like 400 years ago or something. Yeah. So it's a really interesting place. The food is different. Oaxaca has its own cuisine that's somewhat distinct from mainstream Mexican food. It's it's less, like, there's less oil in it. It's more herby. It's really good. Like, there's actually like Oaxacan restaurants you can find in California. Like, a really famous one is Galaguetza in LA.
Oh, okay.
And then there's a handful in other places where you can find like Oaxacan food, which is, it's Mexican food, but it's like, yeah, it's like different enough that it's sort of its own thing. So yeah, it's a really cool place. I loved it there. I would go if it was like, if I had funding in particular to go, but a lot of my work is able to be done in California. So that's kind of how I do research.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. So, and then Panama, research in Panama, I got into, because to be honest, I wanted to visit some family, and I just wanted an excuse to visit them. Like, I wanted to get money to visit them. I have some cousins in Panama, and they found me on Facebook. They told me to visit. I was interested in visiting them. And so I was like, well, I need money to visit. So I could get a little money to visit you guys in Panama if I can get like funding to study a native language there. So I would ask them on like Facebook Messenger, do you guys have any like native languages there? And they would tell me, oh yeah, Primo, we there's a couple, we actually work with them. And I thought, oh, that's great. Let me like look up what those languages are. And like, I was at the library looking up what languages are spoken in Panama. I found some interesting things about them that, you know, just got me super interested in the languages there. And yeah, and then I applied for like a small pre-dissertation grant, and I got that.
Okay.
And then I went there for like 2 summers a while
That's
ago.
Awesome. Panama. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so that was cool. Like, because I got to hang out with my cousins, but but also, yeah, to kind of see the language situation there, which is really different from Mexico.
This marks the end of the second part of this interview. I really want to thank Professor Cisneros for taking time out of his day to do this interview. I hope everyone enjoyed listening, and I'll see you all next time.